Good evening. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington, and this is Crossroads Asia. Tonight on our program, the search area narrows for the missing Malaysian jet. Indonesians go to the polls, and visual effects could change how movies are made in the future. It's all ahead on VOA's Crossroads Asia. The search area for Malaysia Airlines flight MH370 was further narrowed today. That came as authorities confirmed that a vessel in the Indian Ocean had detected two more pings believed to be from the missing passenger jet's black boxes. VOA correspondent Steve Herman reports from our Southeast Asia Bureau in Bangkok.
Officials are expressing more confidence that remnants of the Boeing 777 believed to be at the bottom of the southern Indian Ocean will be located. A U.S. Navy device being towed by an Australian naval ship detected additional transmissions on Tuesday, after another pair of signals were captured days earlier. The chief of the Multinational Search Coordination Center in Perth, Australia, Angus Houston, says, however, it is still premature to declare that the plane's location has been discovered.
I believe we are searching in the right area, but we need to visually identify aircraft wreckage before we can confirm with certainty that this is the final resting place of MH370.
The search has now been narrowed to 75,000 square kilometers, an area nearly the size of the Czech Republic. Officials on Wednesday announced that the earlier pings detected by the American towed pinger locator attached to the Ocean Shield vessel did not originate from natural sources and are consistent with those from flight data and cockpit voice recorders. A top Australian military officer says a thick layer of silt on the seafloor could be muffling the black box transmissions, posing a further challenge to locating the wreckage at a depth few submarines would be able to reach. Before it is feasible to deploy any unmanned underwater vehicles, authorities say, searchers really need to narrow the source of the sonar pings to within a few hundred meters. That is making the search a race against time, as the batteries in the black boxes are already past their expected 30-day life. The expensive search, which government officials in Australia and other countries acknowledge is costing millions of dollars per day, is turning into one of the most comprehensive such undertakings in history. An attempt to retrieve parts of the plane and any human remains on the seabed some 4,500 meters deep would be a more complex and expensive operation. It took nearly 2 years to recover the black boxes from the Air France jet that crashed in the Atlantic Ocean in 2009. The flight recorders were found at a depth of nearly 4,000 meters. The Malaysia flight from Kuala Lumpur on March 8th went off course from its route to Beijing and vanished, prompting an extensive search in what initially turned out to be the wrong areas. Most of the 239 people aboard the plane were Chinese. Steve Herman, VOA News, Bangkok.
This is Crossroads Asia on the Voice of America. Coming up, there's been a deadly market bombing in Pakistan. In Indonesia, voting in the country's legislative elections has ended. The results will set the stage for the world's third largest democracy's presidential ballot in July, likely to be won by popular opposition Jakarta Governor Joko Widodo, also known as Jokowi. The one-day vote today was open to nearly 187 million eligible voters, about one-third of them under the age of 30, who chose from some 200,000 candidates for nearly 20,000 national, provincial, and local seats. Sydney Jones, head of the Jakarta-based Institute for Policy Analysis of Conflict, tells VOA's Victor Beatty the election involving voters in more than 17,000 islands in three time zones was a massive undertaking in the world's largest Muslim nation.
The voting was going pretty smoothly throughout the country. There were a couple of places where voting material couldn't get to the voting places in time, especially in one of the more remote parts of Papua. So that election will be delayed for 1 or 2 days, but it's basically gone quite smoothly and everybody was lining up to do their civic duty.
How important is this vote?
It's very important as an expression of consolidating Indonesia's democracy. Indonesia has been one of the most successful countries that's made the transition from authoritarianism to democracy. But if you look at Thailand, for example, even when things seemed to be going well for a few years, they suddenly reversed themselves, and now Thailand is in a political mess. Indonesia, it's been a steady strengthening of the democratic process over the years, and I think Indonesians should be very proud of that.
Well, the election today was relatively peaceful. Does it encourage you with regard to Indonesia's up-and-coming democracy?
Yes, very much so. The one area that hasn't been peaceful is Aceh, on the northern tip of Sumatra, where we had a peace agreement in 2005 that basically ended a three-decade-old insurgency. And there are a number of reasons that make Aceh special, but that's the one area that we've had very serious violence and where the former rebels are in control of the government at both the legislative and executive levels. But much of the violence has to do with internal dissension within the rebel movement itself. With that exception, I think Indonesia is going to move forward on a steady basis. I think the biggest problem that they are going to have to face is the really endemic corruption that both inhibits economic growth and tarnishes the democracy that it's done so well to sustain.
Sydney Jones, she's head of the Jakarta-based Institute for Policy Analysis of Conflict. Indonesia is still considered a young democracy after emerging from more than three decades of rule by dictator Suharto, which ended in 1998. Incumbent President Susilo Bambang Yudhoyono of the ruling Democratic Party is barred from seeking a third term. If public opinion surveys hold up, Jokowi of the Indonesian Democratic Party of Struggle, who has never held national office, is expected to become the country's next president. Peter McCauley of the Australian National University's Indonesia Project was asked by Victor Beattie the cause of Jokowi's popularity.
It's partly a reaction against 10 years of the current government and the coalition. The current president, who's Susilo Bambang Yudhoyono, commonly called SBY, has in many ways been a good president for Indonesia, but people feel that it's time. It's time there was a change. In a sense, the electorate have simply grown tired of the current faces that they know. There's an excitement for change, and this alternative candidate, Jokowi, seems to look different. He's promising something different. He's promising a change. He's promising a new dawn in Indonesia. And that's if you like, that's selling well to the market, particularly to young people.
Well, what is this dawn going to look like in your view? And he has not run for national office before. Is he ready for this position?
Experienced observers are not really certain of the answers to either of them. His most recent experience has been as governor of Jakarta. Now, Jakarta, that's a very big job. It's a population of 12 to 15 million people. But even so, running the capital city, Jakarta, is certainly very different to running the nation. He's never managed a cabinet. He's never managed foreign affairs. He's never managed economic policy. In fact, we've got very few statements at all on the record as to what his views are. To the extent that we've got indications at all, he has made sympathetic noises to what one might call the ideas of the former leader, the highly popular President Sukarno, who established Indonesia in the 40s and 50s and adopted some rather radical policies. Jokowi is really waving this as a flag. He's simply trying to say that I'm different. So we don't really know what his policies are or how he will manage as leader. He's playing his cards very cleverly politically. He shows every sign of being a quite skilled political leader. In a sense, the electorate are voting for him on trust. But it also means that the truth of the matter is that a very large number of the Indonesian people would not know really what they are voting for. They're voting for an image and they're voting for change, but it's to some extent a leap into the dark.
This is the world's largest, most populous Muslim nation, but its democratic past is rather thin. I believe they've only really embraced democracy in the past 16 years, but in each election they've seen four different presidents and repeated change of the leading party.
There was a long period in the 70s and 80s into the 90s under the dominant leader, Suharto. Now, when that fell apart in 97, 98, there were three presidents in a rush. Three presidents with an average tenure of 18 months to 2 years, so there was a rapid turnover. And it was only with the election of the current president, SBY, Susilo Bambang Yudhoyono, or SBY as he is called, did the political scene return to a situation of substantive stability. So we've had a good deal of stability for 10 years, and there have been now several elections which have been popular. And fortunately, it does seem that democracy has taken strong hold in Indonesia.
Peter McCauley of the Australian National University's Indonesia Project. He says the key issues for Indonesians are basic: jobs, better living standards, improved food, water and energy supplies, and education. McCauley says Jakarta is de facto leader of the 10-nation Association of Southeast Asian Nations, making up 40% of ASEAN's population, an organization it says is becoming more economically integrated. Mark Thompson, director of the City University of Hong Kong Southeast Asia Research Center, tells Victor Beatty Indonesia's young democracy contributes to the region's stability.
It is by far the most important economy in Southeast Asia, and in many ways the most important polity in the region, because democracies have struggled. Think about Thailand, think about the Philippines. So Indonesian democracy has stood out as relatively stable, which has surprised many observers, given the fact that Indonesia is still a relatively poor country on the one hand, and it's very ethnically diverse on the other. But it's been relatively stable. Unfortunately, particularly the last term of the current president has been disappointing. As I mentioned, corruption scandals, economic stagnation, a concern that institutions are weakening. So I think both Indonesians and outside observers are putting a lot of hope in this election, and particularly in the person of Joko Widodo, that he can bring a fresh impulse and revive the reformist tradition in Indonesia to make some of the necessary changes, structural and otherwise, that the country needs to move ahead economically, socially, and politically. Of course, you never know what a new president will do, but Indonesians are hopeful, and the region, of course, is watching closely.
Some 186 million voters, one-third of them are under the age of 30. Indonesia is a young country.
And the other significance about the youthful voters is, of course, they have a limited memory or no memory at all of the dictatorial period, which is, of course, a big influence on older Indonesians who experienced that rather harsh Suharto dictatorship. That did bring economic progress, of course, until the Asian financial crisis. So they are judging Indonesian democracy on its own merits, not just as the alternative to a failed dictatorship. And many of them have become very disillusioned. And I think that's one of the great worries about Indonesia, is young people losing hope in politics. The economic growth that the country's achieved over the last 10 years has been impressive, but it's also been very unequal. So there's also a hope that growth can be more widely spread among ordinary Indonesians. So that's one reason these elections are important, that a lot of particularly young Indonesians are putting their hopes in a political change that will also bring economic and structural transformation.
Mark Thompson, director of the City University of Hong Kong Southeast Asia Research Center. He says while there are radical Islamists in parts of Indonesia, its Muslim-dominated political parties are relatively moderate, and the traditional prejudice against ethnic Chinese is easing, another sign of growing toleration in Indonesia. In Thailand's volatile south, a series of suspected insurgent bombings has killed one person and wounded more than 20 others. Ron Corbin reports for VOA from Bangkok that the attacks pose a challenge to the country's politically deadlocked government and a new Thai army commander in the southern border region.
Thai police and security officials are examining local CCTV footage of images of several suspected insurgents who were filmed prior to a series of attacks in the southern border commercial town of Yala. The powerful bombs, including a vehicle packed with 100 kilograms of explosives, triggered fires in the commercial heart of Yala township, some 1,000 kilometers south of Bangkok, Sunday and Monday. Targets included a major household goods distribution warehouse. It was the first major attack since authorities adopted tighter security measures following a wave of bombings 2 years ago that killed as many as 10 people and wounded scores more.
Nopong Terawon, chairman of the Yala Chamber of Commerce, said the attack appeared directed to undermine the local economy and create fear ahead of Thai national holidays. Nopong said the attacks in broad daylight in the afternoon were the most serious in a decade, with the damage bill running to over 200 million baht, or $6 million, as shops, warehouses and a furniture factory were engulfed in fire. Thailand's southern border provinces have faced an escalation of violence since a long simmering insurgency rekindled in 2004 following the restructuring of security operations under former Prime Minister Thaksin Shinawatra. While Thailand is largely Buddhist, the southern provinces of Yala, Narathiwat and Pattani are mainly Muslim. Over the past decade, the insurgency has claimed the lives of over 5,000 people, both Buddhist and Muslim, including state officials, Buddhist monks, teachers, and Muslims accused of assisting Thai authorities. The killings have included beheadings and the burning of bodies. The Thai security forces have also faced charges of rights abuses and extrajudicial killings. Panasara Matravi, an English teacher at Kanarastom Bungrung School in Yala, says families are moving to nearby provinces or sending their children to Bangkok amid the safety concerns. She called on the government to do more to end the violence.
Yeah, okay. We don't know what is the real reason for the situation. What do they want from... They have done like this. We don't know. I think the government should pay attention, more attention in the southern province.
Panattan Mataniagorn, a political scientist and security analyst at Chulalongkorn University, says the attacks mark a test for the newly appointed regional army commander, General Wallet Ratchanapakdi.
The attacks were designed to weaken the economic growth in the southeast. Of course, Yala is a center of the economic growth. Of course, the success in the attacks translates into the fear, you know, and terror among the general public. It is challenging the new army chief, you know, to do the job more effectively. You know, General Wallet is very new in the area. He's not from the south, as you know. So this is a direct challenge to him. If he's not handled that properly, there could be consequences to him.
Attempts at peace talks under the Yingluck government with groups representing umbrella insurgent organizations have stalled, in part due to Thailand's current political turmoil and protests in Bangkok. A new round of talks, scheduled for last November, was postponed indefinitely. Ron Corbin for VOA News, Bangkok, Thailand.
A bomb explosion in a fruit and vegetable market on the outskirts of the Pakistani capital today has killed at least 21 people and injured dozens of others. The attack comes a day after a train blast left 17 people dead in the southwest of the country. Ayaz Ghul reports from Islamabad.
Witnesses and police say the bomb went off in a section of the bustling market where traders had gathered in large numbers for early morning fruit auctions. Investigators suspected the explosive material was planted in a fruit carton. This shopkeeper says the high-intensity blast sent victims and their body parts flying, and there were bodies scattered all over the area. Rescue teams shifted the dead and wounded to the Pakistan Institute of Medical Sciences in the capital and to a hospital in the neighboring city, Rawalpindi. Dr. Altaf Hussain is the top administrator at the hospital in Islamabad.
We at the moment have 57 patients. About 20 to 23 patients are critically injured.
The attack comes as Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif's government has engaged the Pakistani Taliban in peace talks to end years of extremist violence in the country. The bombing happened just 2 days before a Taliban ceasefire is due to expire. However, the militants denied responsibility for Wednesday's bloodshed. The outlawed Tehreek-e-Taliban Pakistan, in a statement, has condemned the attack as wrong and against Islamic law, blaming it on hidden hands. While the Islamist group routinely targeted Pakistani security forces, It has in the past claimed responsibility for bombing schools, marketplaces and other civilian targets. Speaking to reporters after visiting victims of the blast at the PIMS hospital, Federal Information Minister Pervez Rashid promised the government will bring to justice perpetrators of the market blast. He dismissed suggestions the violence is a setback for peace talks with the Taliban and instead claimed the process has led to a significant reduction in militant violence. The minister said that the Islamabad attack happened after a long lull in such incidents, and for the first time the Taliban has categorically denied its involvement in the attack and strongly condemned it. A bomb and gun raid on Islamabad's court complex on March 3rd had killed more than a dozen people, including a judge. That attack was claimed by a little-known Taliban splinter group, Ehrarul Hind. On Tuesday, a powerful bomb ripped through a passenger train in southwestern Balochistan province, killing at least 17 people and wounding many others. However, Baloch separatists active in the region claimed responsibility for that violence. Ayaz Gul for VOA News, Islamabad.
This is Crossroads Asia on the Voice of America. When you watch a movie these days, it's difficult to tell what's real and what's created in a computer. In the future, visual effects could even alter how movies are made. Elizabeth Lee reports from Los Angeles on how far this area of movie making has come and the next frontier in creating movie magic.
Almost anything that can be imagined by a director can now become reality on the silver screen.
We're really not limited by the technology to build pretty much anything we want.
David Smith of Sony Pictures Imageworks says, with today's computer processing power and speed, the digital world is more realistic than ever before. For The Amazing Spider-Man 2, Smith's team created a Times Square that was indistinguishable from the real one in New York.
If there's lights inside the stores that are lighting areas inside the store, we put those lights in there, all the street lights on the street. We put versions of that into the computer world so that it mimics the real world exactly.
But there is still one challenge remaining for visual effects artists, says Paul Debevic of the University of Southern California Institute for Creative Technologies, who uses this light stage to scan faces and create digital doubles.
We're still trying to figure out how to perfect the human face in movies.
Debevic says the 2008 movie The Curious Case of Benjamin Button is still the best example of a computer-generated face, in this case of actor Brad Pitt. But he says effects artists are now going beyond the stars of today. Last year, they created a digital double of deceased Asian pop singer Teresa Tang in concert with Chinese pop star Jay Chou.
With a ton of data from us and then a ton of artistic effort and technical know-how from Digital Domain, they were able to create a singing face of Teresa Tang where she performed not only one of her original songs, but two songs that weren't even written at the time she was alive with Jay Chou.
Debevic expects directors will start to use more virtual production techniques like those seen in the movie Avatar.
Even though it looks like that's a bunch of expensive technology, ultimately it's going to be much easier to make movies that way.
He says with virtual production, there will not be a need for as many people behind the scenes. David Smith says locations created by a computer can also be more tangible and realistic to actors.
That's where potentially in the future, you know, if we can help create the world in the computer and bring it to the set so they're not acting in front of a green screen, but they're acting, you know, in front of a set that we've sort of mocked up in the computer that eventually will look more grandiose, they'll have something to grasp there.
But visual effects artists agree, even with improved technology and the potential to create anything in the virtual world, there is no replacement for a real actor interpreting a character in a movie. Elizabeth Lee for VOA News, Los Angeles.
Oh, the magic of movies. Well, thanks very much for joining us on tonight's Crossroads Asia. I'm Sarah Williams. Please stay tuned for International Edition with Susan Yaki, coming up next.